Welcome to What the Hex, your source for Warhammer Underworlds in under 30 days before its scheduled release. I'm Davey, your host, and with me is, as always, is Phil. How are you doing tonight, Phil?
I'm doing all right.
All right. Tonight, we are coming to you with some coverage of Dreadfane, because as we release this, it should be just barely officially released, so you can actually get it at stores. We don't have Beastgrave yet. Nova is going on as we speak. Jimmy Molini, he of the Reaver victory over at Gen Con as of this recording, is still 3-0. So Kenny back-to-back repeat. And and I think another exciting one is Dean Bills is over there, and he is also 3-0 on his quest. I think he's got two Grand Clashes under his belt, so Grand Clash victory. So he's going to challenge John Reese. If he can get his third, he can take that as well. So exciting stuff going on over there. But as always, you can get in touch with us at WTHcast. That's on Twitter at WTHcast, or email. We'll cover some of the other stuff again towards the end. But we always like hearing from you. We appreciate it. We've been getting a lot of conversations started up, and that's always fun to chat with listeners. So thanks a lot for doing that. For community shout-outs, speaking of John Reese, who I just mentioned, I wanted to give a shout-out there. He's all over now. He was just on with Battle for Salvation, and I believe he's just recorded with the Path to Glory guys. And once they get back from their escapades at Nova and get a chance to edit that up, you'll probably hear from him again. But he is on top of his win with all 16 warbands. He's also had his third Grand Clash win, which puts him out ahead on his own again. So congrats to him, and you can hear him at some of these other fine podcasts out there.
A true master.
Yeah. The other thing I want to mention is that those boys at Crit Def, Matthew Martin, who was on with us last time, they just dropped their second episode tonight. So if you want a little bit of that vibe, go check that out too. Phil, any community for you?
I've been pretty busy lately, so I have been a bit out of the loop, so don't have anybody to rep off the top of my head right now.
Okay. Well, why don't you tell me what the hex is going on with you?
Well, I have been continuing to hold down the fort for our local league, since somebody has been gone for the last 4 weeks.
Yeah.
But, so we just wrapped up season two of our local league. So we just played for the Glass Trophy, and one of our local Briar Queen players, Matt, won it. So the format that we do at the end of our league is to do the top four players from a ladder, play it out as a round robin of single matches. So you'd play three different people in best of ones, and then the person with the best record at the end wins. And he just won it out off of Glory, because two people were at 2-1.
Oh, man. Okay.
Yeah, cool. It was good. He had a huge last game and scored 26 Glory.
Holy moly. Who was he playing in the last one?
He was playing against Sam, who is running the Ilthari's Guardians.
Okay. He must have been running objectives to run that.
Yeah, budget? Objectives, okay. And keys.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that'll do her. All right. You were in that top four, right, as well?
Were
you
I was. Playing?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Playing Eyes of the Nine. I was in the bottom of the top four.
On that Eyes grind.
So. Yeah.
I'm still on the, speaking of grinds, I'm still on the Ghosts grind here. Right now, I have one key in my deck. Randomly, it is just for a single objective, one of the plus two, which is cool until they figure out which one you really, really want.
Yeah, after round one, and then they're like, well, I'll try and stop you from scoring that again.
Yeah, exactly. So here's where I know that my gaming is reaching the next level. I was experimenting with Frozen in Time, and just triggered that. I'll give you three guesses who I played it on. What fighter I successfully applied it to.
Molog?
No. Try again.
Zarbag.
No. Closer.
Well, I was thinking not Zarbag. Sour Tongue.
No. It was Turash.
Turash? What? Yeah.
I what? Am a genius. Yeah. So.
What?
Yeah, it was.
All right.
I was real desperate to not get pushed off of an objective, and the only guy who had the chance to do it was Tourash. It was right at the end of a round. I was like, I guess I'm gonna frozen in time Tourash so he doesn't somehow bump me off with his two swords attack.
Wow!
So,
yeah. Wow! Overkill.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So highlight moment for them, but. Yeah, it's been good. I got my head kicked in so bad by some profiteers that I was honestly looking at cards like Blinding Flash and Darkness Descends as possible viable candidates to include in. So.
You know, I mean, you say that as like, oh man, these are such fringe cards, but I wonder how much it would catch people off guard. So there's a lot of range in the game now.
There
is. Going down to one sword is really bad.
Yeah. For folks who don't know, Blinding Flash is a reaction, and it changes the attack characteristic of a range 3 to a 1 fury. So particularly good against spell attacks. Great against all of the Thundrix Profiteers. So and a lot of those warbands are up in there. And some of the stuff I struggle with worst is if somebody gets in and starts being a turret and just blowing away chain rasps. So. And the flip, Darkness Descends, is a play, and then the net first attack and the next activation is only range 1.
Yep.
And that actually has some extra play into most of the Guardians, into Molog, right?
Yep.
Drop him down.
Yeah.
So. I think the first time I added that in, the very next warband I played against was Magor's. So
that was of course
deflating. It would be. Anyway, so working them hard, hoping to bring them when we have in a couple weeks here, we're going to go down to Cataclysm Games, I think.
Get. I got to figure out what I'm bringing.
Yeah. All right. Not eyes. Maybe eyes.
I know that I should bring eyes because I've got so much practice with them, but the other side of me is just like, I've had so many games where like, I feel like I've done well and then I just lose and I'm like, well, damn.
Yeah. I think the last one I played was against eyes and I definitely was like, man, I got super outplayed. I just, you know, they were eyes. So
yeah,
once I got Kacharik out, then it was time for Tourash and Narvia to do their thing. And their thing is not much of a thing usually. So
yeah.
We'll get on to our main topic here. So we're going over our first impressions of Dreadfane now that other people can hold it rather than those who noticed and bought it before it sold out. I was one of those sneaky early folks. Noticed online that it should be available and then tried it out. And then I actually brought it out. My brother lives on an island off the coast of Maine. He loves the game, plays it with just a couple people out there. And so I brought him as a late birthday present, the copy I've got. So I'm going to have to go buy it again.
Nice.
Got some games in there. But we're going to cover what's in the box, changes from the main game, overview of the warband, some of the cards we thought were particularly cool. And to that effect, what we hope we saw from this box that we'd see moving forward. In Beastgrave or later developments. So we're not really sure how much this overlaps or not. It may be an indication of where they're headed in the future. So quick kick it off with a quick rundown of what's in the box. Insert 7 meme here, but you've got a double-sided board, which is interesting. So it's like a more conventional gaming board, and it's got you just flip it over either side rather than assembling boards in the traditional way. You got your full complement of tokens, including, kind of cool, faction-specific activation tokens. So like what you'd normally get as prize support. So that's pretty fun. The two warbands are Iron Souls Condemners, who are, what is that chamber? Sacrosanct Chamber?
I think that's right.
Stormcast. And then Lady Hera's Mournflight, who are some Mernmorn Banshees from the main game. They each come with a deck of cards. You got 12 faction-specific objectives and 20 faction-specific power cards. So there's no universals in this box. Curiously, the cards are numbered from 1 to 64 out of 124, which makes you think that there's room for 60 more somewhere. So maybe we'll see an expansion, like a pack of universals or something. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I would kind of hope that it's going to be sort of like Echoes of Glory, but maybe in print longer than that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So I'm not sure how that'll play out, but interested to keep an eye on that. And then notably, there's hazard cards in there. They're the big sort of double-sized cards that add another aspect to the game. And that is kind of a good lead-off for what kind of things you see different in the main game. So, Phil, you and I played a couple times. I mean, it started off like your first roll-off is for the board, right? So, and in this case, instead of like who puts a board first, one player picks which side of the board to use, and then the other player picks where the deployment, who's going to have which deployment zone. That is pretty quick, and then there's no objective placement, right? So
yeah, they're all just directly printed right on the board. So
right,
in some sense, it makes it quick, but it does take some of the strategy out.
Sure, so. I think so. One thing right off the bat that you can see is that one of the objectives is always in neutral territory, and then there's two in each person's territory, and they're all relatively close to the front. There's none that are like thrown way at the back in the long tradition of Thorns and Gits and Sepulchral Guard style, right?
Yeah. You can tell that they're trying to force you to into combat. I think at least it felt that way from our games. And the boards are not completely symmetrical, but it's pretty close. So it's not a huge deal depending on which deployment zone you get.
So I think
that was probably a smart choice, just because it keeps things simple.
Yeah,
for people who are wanting just a quick, you know, jump in and smash each other's faces type board game.
Sure.
Rather than a like deep dive into what is Underworld's kind of experience.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it takes away some of those things that are perhaps more confusing. I remember like the how exactly, like, who wins what, and then how do the boards go down? Like, that takes a little bit of attention to detail to get, and it's not necessarily the most intuitive thing the first time you play normal Underworld. So this kind of removes some of that. I also think board selection, board placement, objective placement, that there's a really high skill cap on that. Like, you can really make a huge change on the game, and so a disparity in skill level between players on that can be really telling, and this here that kind of removes some of that, which with when it's doing what it's intended to do, which is introduce people to the game, I think is a good thing. And it was fun for me as somebody who's played a lot to approach it in a different way.
Yeah, I would agree.
Let's see, hazard cards. So these are big cards. You draw one in the first round before, this happens before you find out who's going first, two in the second round, and three in the third round. But there's a caveat to that. You only draw them if you remember to draw them, which which in our experience was a little bit hard just because it's outside of our normal, you know. So you're excited, get started the game, get halfway through the first activation phase or action phase, and you're like, oh man, those big cards sitting over there right beside the board, we're supposed to do something with those. So having played a number with them, they generally seemed fairly modest in effect. Like I think on average they were probably putting a wound on a fighter or doing a reposition, sometimes a bigger deal, sometimes nothing at all. I think if you're really uptight about them, you might have an issue, you know, if you, oh man, this is, you know, diluting my pure Underworld's experience, then you might have a problem. But when my brother and I were playing, we had some pretty entertaining moments. I think saw blades popped up all around the edges, and so then it was just like, okay, like the you know, I always think of Underworlds when you're going into an action phase. I have a puzzle to solve. What am I going to do with my four activations in this round? And that just kind of shifts the puzzle on you. You can think of it as like a dice roll went in an unexpected way real early on in the game, and now you're trying to accommodate for that. So I didn't find it to be as disruptive as I thought it might be, and pretty enjoyable. I don't know if you remember from ours.
Most of them I felt like were fairly uneventful. It was like, okay, we'll move all the fighters towards a single point, one hex, and it's like, okay, fine. Like, it ultimately didn't have a huge impact because most of the game was focused towards the middle of the board anyway. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the movement stuff wasn't a huge deal. I do remember there was one where it was like, pick a point and then three hexes away from that point, and then like you can deal a damage to everyone in the line or something.
Yeah.
And I just got to do that only to your fighters. Yeah. And so then it was like, well, that felt pretty big because all of a sudden I just put one damage on all your fighters. Which, like, you wouldn't necessarily think, oh, one damage. But when you're facing off against Stormcast, it means the difference between one hit kills or not. So I felt like that one was pretty impactful. But, I don't know. It was because it came up early. So it's still sort of a fairly mild thing. I don't think it ever was anything that I felt like completely changed a game.
Sure. Yeah, I can think of one that happened with us where, we're with my brother and I, where a meteor came down. And actually, I would recommend, if you haven't done this, I occasionally forgot to do this, but would read through the flavor text on it. It was pretty fun, because it'd give you,
sure,
here's what this does. So, like, the dome of this arena, which is like something within Shadespire that you're trapped within and have to fight there. The dome opens up and a star falls out of the sky and drops this meteor right in. And so it did splash damage on some ghosts, but then also created a blocked piece of terrain that then those ghosts were able to take advantage of. So it had a couple interesting effects. My brother was able to, at one point, I thought I had a Stormcast very safe from being killed because he still had all four health. But the edge hexes became effectively lethal. If one damage you're pushed or moved through, actually for each one that you move through. And he equipped like a movement upgrade and then had the 50-50 to do damage when he moved through me. So he charged through me, got the 50-50, attacked me, did two damage, and then shoved me into the edge. No, what? How, this just all fell apart.
Yeah, so. Wow.
But, nice. I could gripe about, like, oh man, like I shouldn't have been able to get killed. But on the flip side, like he had the circumstances change and he was able to take advantage of it in a little bit better way. So I don't know. It's cool. What's something else that we got here, changes from the main game?
So there's some of the rules, just core rules are changed. So I think the one that I felt, ended up being the most impactful, at least in the couple games that we played, was that every kill is just base worth two glory.
Oh yeah.
And that effectively meant that, like, early on getting kills just very quickly escalated into a like untenable situation for the opponent, where it's like, wow, suddenly you've got, all your upgrades out and you're ahead by like four or five glory. Mm-hmm. And now I have to try and catch up when I'm down a fighter. I don't have any upgrades out and you have a bunch of upgrades out.
Right.
And like, so it's basically like every single fighter has a Tome of Glories. And although it's for everybody, it still just meant that, like, if you got that train rolling, it just ran away super quickly. And, I think it was good to speed up the game, and so maybe that's a good thing for people who are just new and want to just play this board game right out of the box and get going quickly. But I do wonder if it's going to have some negative play experiences where people are like, oh man, like I didn't get to get anything going because all of a sudden his guys were like super tough and I couldn't fight them anymore.
Yeah, I can say I played one where, so one thing with this game that is not, people talk a lot about how you can bring those warbands into the main game, but you can actually bring main game warbands into Dreadfane, just bring them in, and then they fight under these rules. So I had one time where I brought Sepulchral Guard in and played them against against the Mourn Flight. Oh yeah, I was going. I was like, man, this feels really, really dangerous. Just, you know, I could give up so much glory. I think I ended up taking it like 18-17, and it was a deck that somebody else on the island here had put together. And it was all about holding objectives. And it was weird. I thought it was going to be like, oh man, all the objectives are right in the middle and I'm just getting slammed. But on the flip side, like every objective was within reach. It was just really very different from any game I'd played in a long time. And to be fair, the Mourn Flight, they don't start with a huge amount of damage. And so, you could, if you had your tankier guys up front, and then a little bit extra help. And then I was bringing in universals like Last Chance and stuff so I think that balanced out kind of nicely. I think, and he just had the stock Mourn Flight deck. But I agree. It can, the two games you and I played, we had rolled real bad one way and then the other, mostly off of an early kill that then snowballed hard. So it increases the snowball if you're going the aggro way, I guess. Let's see. We kind of already talked about hazard cards. That there's the hazard phase, which happens each round before you roll off. One thing that I found pretty interesting, although it didn't come up a ton, is that the guard action in Dreadfane prevents that fighter who's on guard from being driven back.
Yeah. And I think maybe part of that is just because of how the base decks are constructed. There's not a lot of need to be standing on objectives, mm-hmm. Which I think would be the main reason for not wanting to be driven back. But I think there's some really interesting play there, especially if that's going to be something that comes forward into the main game. I don't know that it would.
Sure.
But it feels like a nice subtle buff to objective play, which honestly, outside of Briar Queens, I feel like pretty much everybody who plays objectives could probably use to have that slight buff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think being able to basically stop a pushback from a guard, that could be a nice interesting way of like balancing having to spend actions for that as well as preventing yourself from getting knocked off.
I the other thing I noticed that it helped was your bigger tankier guys, so especially later in the game where the Condemner player started running out of fighters or something, you were short on activations. If you went on guard, if somebody wanted to charge you, you were not only were you less likely to take damage, but you're more likely to be standing there to take your swing back. So I think it helps objective folks, and it helps maybe some of the slower tankier thing fighters. One of the other things I did was put somebody on guard and then walk them forward onto a mm-hmm. spot, and then it was like, okay, now I'm in a spot I want to be, and I'm going to be here, whether, you know, and get my swing the next
yeah, activation. Yeah, I know I'm going to be able to stay where I want. I'm not going to get pushed around too much. I like that, actually. I don't know. I feel like the only reason right now that I go on guard in a normal game is if, like, I'm really on the ropes and my fighter just needs that slight bit of survivability, or if I'm trying to score... keep them guessing or change your tactics.
There it is, yeah.
And it's kind of like, if that's the only reason that going on guard happens, then it feels like it's gotten away from what was the intention.
Sure, yeah. We'll talk more about cards in a bit, but there's a card for the Mourn Flight that is a score immediately. You score it after an activation if the opponent has any fighter on guard, basically. And so I've had a couple times where I'm like, I guess I'll just go on guard. That seems like a safe thing. And then the other player's like, okay, I'll score a glory. Like, damn it. sucks. So that's another use for it, is to give your opponent a glory. One other a pretty nuanced change is that they have something called a super action. So that's any action that's any activation, which is more than one action. So the most common one is a charge, right? So a move and an attack. They call that a super action. And sure. This could also include something like a scything attack. And they have keywords. We'll talk more about those in a bit. But that's one of those where you attack multiple people around you that are all within range. Or even mm-hmm. you could have a charge, which is a move, and then multiple attacks if you're charging into a scything attack. And if you have an inspire condition, you don't inspire until after that super action is complete. And that's significant in the box set here because of Lady Harrow's Mournflight, who inspire by moving through somebody. Off the top of my head, I tried to think of some other warbands that particularly cared about that. I think the one that jumps most to mind is the Gurzag's Iron Jaws, because they occasionally like to either use Shattering Terrain or charge through a lethal to yeah. inspire before they hit. So that's, thank God we're nerfing those guys.
Oh yeah, man. They've just been tearing it up.
Yeah. I worked hard to try and figure out who else. Molog, I've occasionally seen him, if he's at two damage, you know, do a similar yeah. thing to the Iron Jaws. Yep. There's much more edge casey things with other warbands, usually involving like a multiple attack. So like a scything or something like that, or a mighty swing where mm-hmm. you might kill enough people halfway through, and then it'd be cool if you could inspire, but or whatever. But those are pretty few and far between. So
definitely,
I guess it's not a rules change per se, but noticed a lot of bold and keywords on the cards, right?
Yeah, yeah. And to go along with that, then is sort of like the formatting of the wording was also changed. So it's, you know, sort of in broken up blocks of text, so that it's not just one big long paragraph. Which I really hope they're going to be doing going forward, because it does clean up the readability a lot. It's like, here's first condition, here's second condition, here's what happens if you've met all the conditions.
Right, right.
And they'll it's like,
go ahead.
Super easy to just be like, did I meet criteria 1 and 2? All right, then I score this thing. And the wording isn't, it's not like trying to parse where the sentences sort of work together. And yeah. like, yeah, you don't have to be an English major to figure out the meaning of any of these cards now.
Sure. There's one or two that at first glance are maybe a bit clunky. Like I think that one that I was talking about with the On Guard, Frozen in Place, score this immediately. Surge, which is the key word to say, a score immediately. Score mm-hmm. this immediately after an activation if one or more enemy fighters each have one or more guard tokens. And like it's not conversational English, right? So
yep.
So at first glance, you're like, this is actually a little more clunky to read. But if you slow it down and kind of look at what it actually says, then there's no ambiguity, I guess. So
yeah, which I think is the most important thing when you're doing rules writing, because mm-hmm. I don't know how many conversations in the Facebook groups and stuff are just like parsing wording of cards and being like, well, I think if you read it this way, it probably could mean this or that. And then somebody's like, well, that's not really what that should mean. And they're like, well, but it's literally what it says.
Right.
And so then it's, you know, becomes this, you know, rules as written versus rules as intended argument. And then there's like just a understanding of like the logic of how it's worded mm-hmm. and like what that means. And so I think there's a lot of stuff that, well, previously we would have needed FAQs to clear up stuff. I think with this new wording, it really shouldn't have to happen as often.
Yeah. Yeah. And like along the same line as Surge, Duel, which is maybe a more important one because everyone kind of understood how score immediately worked by and large. But Duel is one they introduced, and that's you'll have an if and an and. And it's like you were talking about, there has to be these two conditions met. And so there's no confusion about, you know, maybe a comma here or something like that. You know that both these things must be met. So that's yep. that's a cool thing. I think everyone can get behind that. And you just see things bold, as I think they're working a lot harder on templating their things.
Yeah.
Templating their cards in a way that removes ambiguity.
Yeah. And I noticed along with the bolding, so I think it's only coming up with heal from what I'm seeing, but and then innate. So they'll have the bolded keyword for the thing, and then in parentheses they'll put like
the a value
affectations. So yeah. Heal one or innate dodge. And that way they can template everything out with keywords and still have this very clean, discrete, like, this is what is happening from the keyword. And I like that.
Yeah. I think that covers most of the changes that jumped out at me. Was there anything else you wanted to touch on?
I mean, other than some of the new keywords, some of the new rules and stuff, which we kind of sort of grazed past a little bit with like scything and stuff. But so I think it's just there's scything and ensnare or
yeah, that's it.
Ensnare. Yeah, yeah. So scything is the old rules that would say, like, when you make this attack, target all adjacent enemy fighters. It's just shorthand for that, which is obviously nice. It saves space on cards. It can then go under the attack profile rather than having to be a separate box in the side.
Mm-hmm.
So save space on the card. And then ensnare, which isn't actually on anything in the base box set, but it is just the dodge equivalent of cleave. So instead of ignoring blocks, you ignore dodges, which I think is a very welcome addition to the game, because three or four dodge fighters is starting to get really old.
yeah, I've done a little of that in my day. Yeah, I mean, I like to think that some of that's coming in and kind of redress the balance, because the value of having one block as your defense has really kind of gone downhill as more and more cleave becomes available.
Yep.
Well, let's talk about these. We've kind of touched on the warbands a little bit incidentally. We're going to give, so it's our intention down the line, we'll probably revisit these warbands and give them an honest top to bottom review, including universal cards that we might include and so on and so forth. But given that Beast Grave is about to drop and we don't have as many reps with these folks as we might otherwise, we're going to save that. And we're just going to kind of give our first impressions a brief overview of them both. Phil, you want to pick one of these warbands and rock it?
Sure. So I think the easier one to start with is Iron Souls Condemners. They're the Stormcast model, so you know they've got the three fighters. We can sort of just know that at least so far all the Stormcast are three models.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like they're just going to continue to use that template. Their base move three, they start on block. The interesting thing about these guys for inspiring is that they need to roll crits, which that's not impossible. It is very swingy, so there are times where you could inspire really quickly, and then there's times where you could just fail to roll any crits and you just wouldn't inspire ever, and that is going to be probably very frustrating, I would think, for playing these guys.
Yeah, it feels pretty similar to Steelheart's Champions, where they have to roll a block or a crit on defense dice. And you have some games where you just never succeed on a defense roll and then never get inspired. Or you inspire right as you die or something like that. Like, oh, I rolled a shield, but you have cleave and that was lethal damage and I'm gone. And those games just feel very different. The games where you inspire right away versus, these at least you have the chance to force it to trigger or have a chance to, have it trigger by making your own attacks, but you're crit fishing. So
yeah, and I will mention here that these guys they don't gain a lot from getting inspired though either, so in that sense it's kind of okay. Leader gets so I guess the big thing is they all get plus one defense, which mm-hmm. is kind of like Steelheart's Champions. They feel, in a way, a lot like that. So they're going to be pretty tanky once they're inspired. But other than that, like, their offensive profiles, your leader gets plus one damage and knockback. It's kind of like, yeah, okay. I guess she gets that special thing where she can get more knockback.
Yeah, which, knockback two, right, on a crit.
on a three damage attack, so... Yeah. I don't know how many people you're hitting that aren't going to die off of that first hit. So
yeah, it feels like she gains a fair amount. Like plus one damage, plus one defense, you know, the knockback is whatever. But when you're on three hammers doing three damage, that feels pretty tasty for an attack.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I mean, I think it's good. It's just kind of like three hammers for two damage without being inspired is still pretty solid. And so it's kind of like, well, if you don't roll those crits, yeah, I guess you're okay. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not essential. It's obviously nice, but I think you'd be okay. And then, like, the rest of them, like Blightbane, he gets a scything attack, but his main attack profile, other than, well, like, he gains cleave, I guess, is the other thing. But, like, his hammers and damage stay the same. And then Tavian, again, like, his stuff mostly stays the same. His shield slam, he gets extra damage on, and then he can like follow the person as he drives. Yeah,
it's a really weird ability that I've literally never used.
So. I'm not quite sure. There's a few upgrades that do the same thing where it's like, after you drive this person back, you can push your fighter into the hex that they left. And it's kind of like, I'm not sure why I'd want to do that. So maybe there's something there, but I personally have not, seen a use for it. So shorthand, these guys are pretty much Seal Hearts champions with some modified stats, and that's really about it. Which is not bad. Steel Hearts champions are perfectly viable. It's just not very flashy, I guess.
Sure. So that shield rest, though, it has knockback too. It's a weird thing where he hits somebody, he would send them 1, 2, 3 spaces and then move another 3. Like, it's a weird zoomy mobility boost, but it's on a 2-hammer attack. I don't know. It's just so strange.
I feel like you just get out of position, too. Like,
yeah.
I don't know.
My impression on their cards is that they tended a lot towards healing. There were a lot of ways to heal yourself, and then a lot of teamwork sort of things. Like, lots of the objectives require two of them to be alive, two people standing next to each other, or two people who are inspired, or, you know, that sort of thing.
And that feels like what they like to do with Stormcast. It's like everybody's standing together and everybody's, you know, doing stuff, and it's like, it's so hard to keep everyone alive. Yeah. Like, this, like, unless you're really playing very just like, I'm not gonna get into combat at all, you're probably going to lose somebody.
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden stuff gets hard.
Yeah. I will say I found it either really hard or really easy, which is weird to say. Like, either you, like we're talking about, either you get that early kill and they get 2 glory, which gives you defensive upgrades, which lets you keep them alive, which lets you keep them together and keep doing stuff. Like, or you lost one and then another real quick. And all of a sudden you're like, well, now half my objective deck is bricked. And, you know, this card that I have that gives me innate single support is worthless and all that. So, it was, I mean, I think we've talked about, like, if you're fishing for crits, it's kind of swingy, and that's kind of applies to some of their other stuff too. But yeah, it is hard to keep everybody together with 3 move.
Yeah. But overall, I think they're a good warband, and I think it's good to have them in a starter box like this, because they give you a nice, solid, good stats, good survivability. They're like, you know, they're middle of the pack, and they don't require a lot of like super complex strategy to make them work. So, I think Stormcast are always pretty beginner friendly, and I think that's a good thing to have in a box like this.
Sure. The Mournflight, on the other hand, so you got 4 Banshees. They all start at 2 dodge, which is pretty spicy. I know when I was playing, my brother's apologizing for the crits he's rolling. I was like, well, if you roll 2 dice on every roll, like, they're going to pop up more than you'd expect, or, you know, apparently. But pretty speedy, speed 4 to start, 5 when inspired. They kind of have wounds all over the place, the 2, 3, and 4. Most of them get an extra wound when they inspire, and they inspire by moving through someone, which is kind of cool.
Yeah. Yeah. When I first read it, I thought, oh man, they're just all going to get inspired right away, and it's going to be sort of crazy. But it it kind of forces you into some potentially bad positioning. And I think that's sort of the trade-off, right? Is that they get pretty good and they've got pretty good starting defense, but then all of a sudden they're probably just going to be getting attacked a lot.
Yeah.
And while two dodge is good, it's not untouchable by any means. And so with three wounds, you could very easily go down in just one hit. And I mean, it's half your warband is going to, even inspired, going to be only at three wounds. So you do have to be a little bit careful there.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're all pretty interesting when they inspire. The widow starts at three damage. Does a lot of damage. It's pretty inaccurate right out of them. She gets this crazy movement ability where she can just, for an action, move herself to any empty hex and gets a move token. That's only when inspired, which is, again, it's hard to do because she might have just moved through somebody and then got smoked in exchange for that. So I remember looking at that ability thinking, wow, like, that is really cool. And then I've never seen anyone use it because it's she's often a candidate for getting killed first because her health is so low. The Angus one, I think, has something where crits don't count in defense, which is a lot better than I realized. It means if she rolls any crits in her attack roll, it's definitely going through. There's no way.
Yep. Auto successes, yep. Which is insane.
Yeah. Maiden on a crit, she goes up to four dice on Fury, and a crit is plus one damage. So she's accurate and actually does a fair amount of damage. And Lady Harrow has a weird one that, again, is hard to remember to do, but somebody attacks somebody other than her, she can push.
Yeah. Well, and I think the super weird thing with hers is that that's like a new react. Well, it's not a completely new reaction window, but it's one that has very few cards that happen after declaring an attack.
Mm-hmm.
So it's before any of the dice are rolled or anything. So it's an interesting one. It could, man, I don't know. I think there's so much potential around it, but I really haven't even wrapped my head around like what I would want to do with it necessarily. So,
yeah. I mean, I think what you can take away from us, and we've only talked about their fighter card so far, by and large, is that we've said the word interesting a lot, which is to say there's a lot of things that you could do. They're just the learning curve is going to be real steep, and they might have a pretty high ceiling as far as how good they can be if you really learn how to use them well.
I would agree. Yeah. And I think they can be very strong flex. I think the way that the Dreadfane game has you playing them, they're pretty aggro, and I don't know that that's always to your best, in your best interest. But yeah, I think depending on how you would build a deck for them, they could be very strong once you get the hang of like what's the inspiration order, who do you need for certain matchups, because like,
yeah,
I feel like they've got this big toolbox, but you have to be very specific. Like your choices are going to be very important in what you do and who you choose to inspire first, and I don't think that's immediately obvious.
Sure, and I think even more of that comes through in their cards, and this is probably as good a time as any to jump into. We're going to talk some about theirs, and of course the Condemners. So some of the cards, let's go with that though. We're going to run down some of the cards that we thought were pretty interesting. But what do you think is particularly good for making the Mourn Flight, that flex warband? Because I think a lot of this comes from their cards.
Yeah. My mind immediately goes to the, like, other cards that are out there, but I think to just keep it within stuff that's in Dreadfane, one that I found to be really cool, well, there's a few, but Fleeting Memories, I think, is one that I found to be really nice and just super easy to score, and that's a score immediately where if you make a move where you enter two or more objective hexes during your move action, you score a glory. And what that effectively means is that in a lot of cases, you could charge and get a glory for doing your charge. You could just be moving around in your backfield completely safe and get a glory that way. You can combine it with a few of the other things that they have as well. The one that comes to mind immediately is a card, what's it called, where you move through a blocked hex, Inescapable Hunger.
Oh, yeah.
Where I think you could probably, I don't know if you can do it off of the boards in the Dreadfane box just because of the positioning, but you're fast enough where you could theoretically move through two objective hexes and go through a blocked hex and end next to an enemy fighter on a charge and score two score immediately and potentially get that kill in Dreadfane, a four glory swing off of one activation, which would be pretty nice.
Pretty spicy, yeah. So they're picking up glory by doing some things that don't necessarily require successful dice rolls, which always perks up my interest. You know, you want to find a way to reliably get some glory to get things moving, even if the dice are not landing in your favor. I think another one that was cool was One Will. And this is where they have to hold, I thought this was particularly cool, hold an even-numbered objective and an odd-numbered objective. And if they do, I think it's a score immediately as well.
We'll check it that. Is. Yeah. So it's at the end of any of your activations. So it's just like once you get two people on objectives, you score this immediately. So could be off of pushes. And then someone makes an activation in the next round and you could score it that way, or just like move two fighters and then you get it, which I think is nice to see some stuff with objectives that's not in the end phase.
Sure. Yeah. I think we first saw something like this with Focal Formation. And I think at the time we said that it was something that we thought was cool and wanted to see more of. So
yeah, definitely.
So those were cool. Sticking with the Mournflight, also with their objectives, they have a Dominion of Death, which is a third end phase, and they have to have scored more objectives. And I don't think this is, I mean, it feels very similar to a Superior Tactician, right? Same payout, and rewards, scoring lots of small ones on the way. You don't have as much control. Like if you're playing against, I don't know, like Thundrix Profiteers, who are probably scoring a ton of them, you may not win that race.
I think the thing I like about that card though, is that it, and maybe that's not like the immediate reaction when you read it, but I think that it potentially rewards you for playing Denial. And I think that that could be really strong, where you set yourself up in such a way that you're basically saying, I know I'm not going to score very many cards potentially, but because I'm flex, I can score without attacking. And then I'll just deny my opponent's scores. And then just because my opponent couldn't score, I get more stuff.
Sure. And I think the other way to kind of goose this in your favor is they're scored sequentially, right? So if you activate first in the third round, then you get to count. You get to compare the total before they've scored any of their third end phase stuff.
That's a very good point. I like that a lot actually, because then even if you're keeping even pace, then just by the nature of how the turns play out, you would be able to still get that one. And a three glory, it's three glory, right?
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, yeah. So a three glory swing could be enough to change a game.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, they're big, right? So
yeah.
What else? What else do you like, Phil?
I like Nexus of Terror is another one that I thought was interesting. I don't know how much you play it, especially in the way the box set is set up, but it's holding the most objectives in an end phase.
Yeah.
So it's not a specific number. And so if your opponent's playing aggro or something and they're just, by and large, they're just not going to want to sit on objectives, you just camp one and you get two glory. And that's pretty huge. And you could even juice that a little bit more with some of the like tactical supremacy ones, where hold two of a specific numbers, and then you could be getting that and this for holding two objectives and get four glory for it. And I think that's pretty strong on a relatively small investment. You wouldn't have to go like full hold objectives to take advantage of this. It's kind of almost like the Lamen, what is it? The Lamentary one.
Reclaim the Lamentary. Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. It's kind of the same idea, except that that one is still hold all of them in one territory, but you can kind of game that with placing the tokens.
Sure. Yeah. And what I this feels like almost a iconic flex card for that lets you score for making objectives important, but you can get it more in your favor by attacking and bumping people off objectives, or by using distraction, or they have a distraction clone in their deck. Any of those pushes that are pushing other fighters that are useful for aggro play and all that, or disruption, but they also help this without you having to invest a whole bunch in things like a sidestep or, you know, feign way or whatever, which, you know, still might be useful to you. But I like the alternate angle it takes at going after the stand on objectives style.
For sure.
For me, I wanted to give a shout to Chilling Scream, which is a ploy, a gambit that it's very similar to No Time. So it says your opponent cannot play power cards, but it only lasts for the power step, but also it does not affect you, unlike No Time. So there's some subtle differences there, where you can't use it to try to deny a last chance or a ready for action in the next, or not ready for action, I guess that would work. But like, you know, if you're expecting to see a last chance or a rebound or something like that, it won't shut those out, because it won't help against reactions there, but it will let you keep playing stuff. This feels, you know, every time I brought No Time, I was like, oh, I'm going to play this at such the perfect time, and I'm going to be such a genius, and it would never quite land. And this just keeps that dream alive for me. I can keep dreaming of the day where I'll be a genius when I play this card and never actually see it. So I did have a go off a couple times where I was planning on like a real tasty counterattack where it was going to increase the... it was early on. I was going to increase, put an upgrade for attack accuracy on somebody, and it was denying that. And now I'm like, oh man, do I go in now on the charge, or do I delay another? So I saw it be useful, but I think you really have to be able to read the game state really well to get the most out of this. But
for sure,
No Time is a pet card of mine, as far as dreaming. I've never played it well, so
we'll make it work.
Yeah, right.
I like to go into some of the ploys. I like Enervating Sorrow a lot. Enervating Sorrow is a reaction where when your opponent plays a ploy, before it's resolved, they have to then choose to discard a power card, or the ploy that they are currently playing does not resolve. And that, especially if you know your opponent's deck and your opponent's cards fairly well, so say you're in like match two or three, or round two or three of a match, I feel like you could pretty easily see the big plays coming and be like, all right, there you go. Have fun trying to decide what you're going to mess up in your hand versus messing up your current play. I could imagine seeing this in a number of situations being very disruptive, and I feel like it would probably put your opponent on tilt a little bit, because they probably wouldn't be expecting it, and then they suddenly have to sort of disrupt their plan to make a pretty hard decision.
Sure.
And even if it doesn't really mess up what they're going to do right then, it's probably going to have them... like it'll take them out of, you know, their game plan a little bit. And I feel like even that can be enough to make people make mistakes. And I kind of like cards like that.
Yeah, so there's some decks that I play where I really am expecting to use like everything in my hand. I guess theoretically every deck I play should be like that, but it's not, right? Like there's some I lean on more so than
there's
others.
There's always some situational stuff.
Sure. I call this the card that makes me discard Thunderous Smite, which is the it's the Condemner's reaction that turns an attack into a splash action, which I've not found a use for yet. Yeah. I think played early, it often just means that they'll discard an upgrade instead of a power card. But I think played in round two or round three, it can get big. And especially if you're playing against somebody who's trying to hold objectives and they're counting on, okay, I'm going to sidestep somebody at the last minute. They don't have another sidestep in their hand, most likely. You know, so if you can bleed it out far enough, you can make it pretty brutal. So, that's a good pick. I'm going to hop onto some Condemner cards here real quick. Or actually, here's my transition. It's Hollow Hatred and Etherically Charged Weapon, which are mirror images of each other.
Yeah.
And they give a reroll one dice in the first attack roll that this fighter makes. So it's like Awakened Weapon, but only for the one attack. And interestingly, because the first attack, it's not the first attack after you apply the upgrade. It's the first attack they make in the round. So if you put it on after you've already made an attack, you're going to have to wait till next round to reap the benefits. But I like it because it's powerful, but not ridiculous. It's nothing that's going to have to get restricted like Awakened Weapon did.
Yeah. Yeah. I think they both, they sort of walk a nice fine line of like, this is really strong, but not so much so that it's going to cause problems. And I hope that that's a sign of being sort of aware of what parts of the game are problematic now. And they can kind of help to avoid some of that going forward too.
Mm-hmm. I would say for another, and this is kind of a pair. One is an upgrade and one is a ploy. There is Punishing Blow, which is restricted to Brodus. It's an upgrade. It's an attack that he gets to make once, but it what an attack to make.
Yeah.
It's three dice hitting on smash, doing four damage, and has cleave, which, pretty juicy. So it's more accurate, not only because of the extra dice, but because of cleave, especially if he's not inspired. And then an extra damage. That's pretty fun. In some matchups, it's just going to be way overkill, but in others, it's a very nice surprise smash hit. And I thought the good partner to this was Improvised Blow, which is a ploy which allows you to make an extra attack. So you just make that attack right off the bat, three needing fury doing one damage at one range, which is a pretty modest attack, but it's a way to sneak in one extra damage. But it's not too crazy. But if you have, the thing is it unlike some of these other gambits that do just one damage straight off, you know, we're thinking of course like Encroaching Shadow or whatever, this or even spells, which are more likely to go off than this attack is to land, this does benefit from any other things you might have on your fighter. So if you have something that is making your fighter do an extra damage on crits or has great strength or something like that, then you get to leverage that with this. And I think it's really cool to have this sort of one-off attack in Gambit 4, and I think that's the first time we've seen that design space be used.
Yeah, I think for sure. I think the only other thing that comes close is Ready for Action, and that's obviously quite a bit stronger because it's letting you make whatever attack they have on their card, which is why it's restricted.
Right, exactly.
So yeah, I like that it's subtle. It's not going to be super busted by any means. And I think it's almost like you get to have a Gore Fist, but it's such you get to choose when you use it. And I mean, the threat of having a Gore Fist is enough to make people worry a bit about attacking those guys. So knowing that standing next to one of these guys in the Iron Souls Condemners means that they could just choose to just, you know, quick jab you with that, might even be enough to make people think twice about hanging around too long.
Sure.
At low health.
Yeah. And I guess besides the possibility of the one damage, it also comes with the possibility of a drive back, right? So,
sure. Yeah.
That, which is a pretty big deal. Get somebody who walked next to you with the, you know, intention to then swing for the next three activations, and you just give them a little improvised blow. Entertainingly, the art, I think what I'm looking at on the art in this is that, Iron Soul, the leader, is headbutting a banshee, headbutting a ghost, which...
Okay.
I think that's what's happening. Yeah, that's either genius or madness. I'm not sure which. So, but yeah, I thought there's a cool pair of cards. Anything else you want to add into our cool cards section here?
Well, I guess one upgrade here that's, I think, kind of cool... is Sanctified Armor.
That's exactly what I was going to bring up if you didn't.
Yeah. So this one is, it reduces damage dealt to the fighter by one to a minimum of one. What I like about this, so it's very similar to the, I'm not going to remember what it's called, but it's from Magor, where he reduces damage from attacks by one.
Gory Visage?
Yeah, that one. Which is obviously really good, but that's restricted to just Magor, and it only reduces damage from attacks. This is all damage. I don't know if you'd ever take damage that's more than one from a non-attack source, but if it ever came up, there's something you could do to reduce it. And it can go on any of your fighters. So,
oh, yeah.
It's a nice survivability boost, and on fighters with four health, reducing damage by one can actually mean two, maybe even three extra hits that they can take before they go down.
Right.
If you have any wound upgrades, or if your opponent is hitting for only two damage at a time.
Or if you're using any of the fair number of healing cards that come with these
yeah,
guys.
Yeah, right. Yeah, so... you know, there's a tendency to look at, oh, one damage, it's not that big a deal, but it actually changes the math pretty significantly and can make a fighter pretty tough. And I sort of make the point of saying that this can go on any fighter because it can be very nice as a situational boost to just be like, oh, you were about to put all these resources into this specific fighter, I've now made it so that you can't kill them, basically.
Sure.
And being able to take the wind out of somebody's sails like that is always frustrating. It's maybe not quite to the same degree as, demonic resilience or something like that, but sure. This will last longer.
Yeah, and that's really cool. I had not noticed the fact that it was not restricted to attacks, and I can... What immediately jumps to mind is I've had my heart broken by Sorceress Riposte and a couple Cursebreaker decks that have a lot of the ability to bring extra channels. So it's a gambit spell you use as reaction, two channels. Play this after you miss a wizard, and then if they can cast that, they'll blast two damage back at you, which feels real bad. So corner case as far as outside of attacks, but. An important one to remember, and something that'll catch people out if they haven't noticed that. So I think that that's a pretty good rundown on the cards we're looking at. We've touched on it a number of times, but let's just give a quick. So thinking that maybe depending on when this is developed, this might have some indicators what we might see going forward. What did you see? Just summarize again for us, I guess, what you saw here in Dreadfane that you hope to see in future Underworlds releases.
So I think in order of what I want to see carried forward, keywords, the sort of improved wording formatting on the cards, and then carrying forward the new special rules. So things like scything and snare.
Yeah, I agree. I think I like the subtle tweak to the guard action, just to kind of bring it up.
Mm-hmm.
It makes me realize that, you know, some of the core rules that you would have assumed that are kind of, stuck in amber going to be what they're going to be. Those are up for minor tweaks here and there. So I'm interested to see where they go with that. And I don't know if this was a side project to just sort of experiment with some mechanics and see if they like it, or if it's something they're planning on doing anyway and going forward. So I guess we'll see in a couple weeks here, or a month. Or
yeah, hopefully.
For Beastgrave, yeah. So, yeah, pretty cool. Pretty fun to see a release like this in the mix. So,
yeah.
I think that about covers it. Anything else you want to say on Dreadfane?
I think I'm just really glad to see a nice way to try and bring people into the game that is not a starter box, because well, the starter boxes are a good way to get everybody, like, here's all the stuff you need to play, and like, here's basically two decks plus extra cards to build with once you've played once. I think that's great. I think that's good if someone is like actually wanting to think like, hey, I want to get into this game and I'm going to go like all in and learn how to play this, and I want to, you know, dig in, and I've done miniature gaming before. I think if you're coming from the outside and you're like, hey, these are cool models and I like board games, what's this thing about? I think the starter boxes are still pretty daunting. I think there's a lot to learn. There's a pretty steep learning curve once you get past the basic rules, and I think that by limiting some of the early setup pieces, it just helps people get into games faster.
Sure, that's a good point. Yeah,
and I think it'd be cool if they could keep stuff like this going, sort of on a once or twice a year kind of thing, just to have a little break from the regular release, just to throw some new stuff out that sort of helps new players and supports the main game at the same time.
Yeah, I think anything that brings more players in is going to be great for the game. I'm glad to see it. And I think what's cool is that they can, maybe Beastgrave drops and there's no rule variations whatsoever, but somebody can take one of these decks, one of these warbands, and then just go play Underworlds with somebody with a, once they've got Dreadfane down, it feels like a nice, easy next step in, which is exactly what they're hoping for. So,
sure.
Well, I think that's probably going to do it for us tonight. As always, you can get in touch with us at WTHcast and whatthehexcast@gmail.com. Thanks to the folks who've dropped us reviews. They continue to flow in. Jip Jipperson not only dropped us a review, he hit us up on Twitter, gave me a good idea, which I should have been doing this whole time. It only took us 21 episodes to come around to it. But his suggestion is that we put a card list. He was asking for a list of the cards. So what I'm going to try and do is there will be, in the show notes, there'll be a link of any card we mentioned. Well, it'll just be one big pile. So if you're somebody who's not super familiar with the cards, you can click on that. And then if we mention a card, it'll be somewhere in that list. So rather than trying to frantically sort through the bigger list. There's a fellow on Podbean with another one of those nonsense Podbean names, but he gave us kudos, and then he said, tell us what that corn conversion is, you cagey bastard. I think that means directed at you. So, you want to discuss or leave it be for a while?
I mean, sure. I don't think there was a whole lot more to say. I don't remember exactly what I said before, but I guess what I'm working on is a barbarian Gur tribe of corn followers, and with the idea that they're like using mammoths and thunder tusks and stuff. So I'm going to convert a war altar with a thunder tusk on top, or a thunder tusk carrying the war altar, and then try to do a war mammoth conversion, because I don't want to shell out $1,000 for one of those things. And then just, you know, making all the reavers and everything have bone and fur, and they're going to have snow bases. And I don't know, it's been a fun project. I haven't done conversions much before, and it's starting to look pretty cool, but it's a lot of work. I have not gotten very far on it yet. And, I was expecting it to go a little faster than it has. So It's been fun, but it's going to be a longer term project than what I initially thought.
Yeah, so goes the way of all conversions in my experience. But I think you've had some work in progress stuff. We don't often mention it, but we do have a Discord that is sort of Discord for all the podcasts in the Mortal Realms family within that network. I'll put a link to that in the show notes. You should come on and have a chat with us there. There's a pretty good crowd. Speaking of the Mortal Realms network, we do have a new podcast in the mix. Eric Pivon, Josh, and Aaron are all on their Dogs of Warcry, which is all about the Warcry games. If you want to know more about that, they've just released their first. By the time you hear this, they'll be gearing up for their second. Talking about the Warcry game. Go check it out. Good stuff. You can check out any Mortal Realms content you want at themortalrealms.com. Our cast is on there. I should also say that we are also available now on Stitcher. We're available on Spotify, the web player. There's still troubleshooting why we're not showing up on an app. We should be, but we are not as of the time of this recording. So hopefully be there soon if those are your preferred listening platforms. That's about it. You can drop us a review. We always appreciate it. Your recommended listening for this episode is Another Day Full of Dread. That's by Bonnie Prince Billy. It's from I See a Darkness, an excellent album altogether and an appropriate song. That's it for What the Hex. I've been Davey.
This is Phil.
All right, we're recording.
Cool.
It's like we've done this before. And I already blanked. Son of a bitch. And aside, condemners, every time I write that word, I'm convinced I've spelled it wrong. It is a weird word, but...